to Macro Business Radio Podcast. Today I'm talking with David Llewellyn-Smith and Leith Van Onselen about the 2015 Macro Business Christmas Report and the outlook for the Australian economy. Leith, I'll go first to you. We've had GDP data and employment data in recent weeks, which have both surprised to the upside. How credible do you find that?
I'll start with the national accounts first, which is where the GDP comes from. Quite frankly, it wasn't that convincing. Pretty much all the growth was driven by net exports, and actual domestic demand continues to fall, and so does national disposable income. So what we've got a situation where Australia's economy is growing because it's selling more dirt and more gas overseas, but the prices that we're receiving for those exports are actually falling quite swiftly, and profit margins and national income is actually getting crunched, and actual spending within the domestic economy, once you exclude those exports, is actually going backwards, at least on a per head basis. So the headline looked all right, but once you get past the headline, it wasn't particularly good. And turning to employment, the latest figures are, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, if you look at their seasonally adjusted figures, which is all the stuff you hear about in the press, we had the strongest 2 months of jobs growth for something like 28 years. Quite frankly, it doesn't pass the laugh test. There's clearly something wrong there. It's not correct. That being said, there has been some decent growth over recent times, at least over the last 6 months. And that seems to be related to the housing booms going on in Melbourne and Sydney, which is juicy retail sales and car sales and all manner of spending. So for the time being, it's okay. But as we'll get to shortly, there are some big headwinds ahead.
Dave, you've got some thoughts on that?
Adding to what Lee says, Glenn Stevens yesterday said that this services sector jobs growth, at least referring to in the big caps of the eastern states, was transpiring without any capital investment. Because at the moment, the outlook for capital investment in services nationally is still to fall quite firmly over the next 12 months. And that throws up a rather interesting question about how sustainable it is. If it's not based on expansions in factories or expansions in malls or expansions in anything, physical capital, then just a kind of confidence trick where rising house prices and probably, I think, an impact from the rise of Malcolm Turnbull has loosened up the purse strings a little bit. It basically means the jobs growth is coming from a little bit of a rise in confidence, which isn't following through to actual physical investment. So it's probably quite vulnerable to reversal if there's a little more discomfort, which appears to be coming in the federal budget and, you know, from offshore.
That brings us back to you, Leith. How sustainable do you see the GDP or employment strength?
Well, GDP for the moment's probably okay, just because we've still got a rise in export volumes. And those rising volumes, despite the fact that prices continue to fall and will keep doing so, will mean that the headline GDP figure looks okay. But as we've pointed out numerous times on Macro Business and also in the special report, GDP is pretty much a meaningless figure. The things you need to look for are domestic demand and also national disposable income, which will continue to fall. As to unemployment, employment's been held up by the huge housing boom / bubble in Melbourne and Sydney, which is juicing all kinds of consumption spending, cars, retail, etc. The housing markets look like they already are weakening, and we believe they will start to go backwards from mid-2016, and that should end the party.
So, David, as a response to those types of pressures on the economy, how credible was the MAIFO?
Not very. It had the usual problem, which is this terrible methodology that Treasury has for commodity prices, in particular iron ore, where they just assume and base it on you know, like the last 30 days of prices, which is really ludicrous given you've got a very credible futures market now for iron ore. And you should just use that. They projected a price on iron ore of about $45. Futures are already pricing $35. So that $10 difference is worth $3 to $5 billion over the forward estimates per annum that they're already underwater. And they rounded down some of their growth targets in the years ahead, but nowhere near enough. So again, we'll be back to where we have been every May and every MAIFO virtually since 2011. Next year, which will be, you know, more missed projections, more damage to the government's credibility, and more damage to confidence, which, you know, it appears they sort of lie about these things to try and sustain confidence, but of course they drag themselves down and dent it anyway.
One of the more notable responses to the MAIFO is coming from the ratings agencies, which are now starting to question the AAA How big a threat is that for the government?
Well, I think we'll be lucky to have the AAA within 12 months, maybe 18. The ratings agencies are definitely getting uncomfortable with the trajectory of the debt to GDP ratio, net debt. And I'm sure that it must register with them somewhere that the government has missed every forecast consistently for 5 years. They are yet to round down their own forecasts for commodity prices and iron ore and what have you. So when they do that, it would, you know, perhaps become, you know, even more alarming for them. You know, at this stage, like they've basically said, if the Senate passes the $20 billion or so in cuts and the government meets its new forecasts, then, you know, it'll be okay because we're still on a path to surplus by 2022, I think it is now. But, I mean, that's, of course, bullshit. And so, you know, perhaps one more year is enough for them to finally say, well, this is not surplus. This is not pursuit of surplus across the cycle, which is what they want to see for the AAA rating. And they'll start to warn.
It's been a base case for macro business, certainly in last year's annual report and again in this year's, that from 2016 onwards, certainly mid-2016 onwards, Australia faces three significant economic shocks. They are the continued downturn in mining capex expenditure, the closure of Australia's car industry and the implications that has for the wider manufacturing industry, and also the rollover of housing expenditure for both real estate prices as well as for employment and also subsequent retail expenditure. Leith, can you tell us how we're stacking up against those three risks at the moment?
About a third of the way through. Mining capex, we're about a third of the way through the fall. We've got about another two-thirds to go. The annual national accounts, which are current up to June 2015, showed that mining capex to GDP was 5.9%, which is down from the peak of 7.5%. We believe it'll get down to probably 1.5% of GDP, which is about what happens after, you know, what's happened after previous capex booms. But it's just as likely to go down to 1% of GDP, which is where it has been doing in the past. And given the magnitude of this boom, you could undershoot. So, you know, we're probably only one third of the way through the mining investment boom unwind. And over the next 2 years, it's, you know, it'll probably bottom. So we're looking at acceleration of the decline over around the next 2 years. The car industry commences closing down in October 2016 when Ford closes, and then that'll be followed in, I believe, early 2017 by Holden and Toyota. Now, there are some different estimates about what that means for jobs, but on the sort of the less conservative side, from the Productivity Commission, Allen Consulting, they believe that about 40,000 jobs are going to go primarily in South Australia and Victoria, whereas the really pessimistic forecast by some academics is set up to 200,000 jobs will go. So either way, it's a pretty bad number. Also, the forward indicators on housing suggest that the housing construction boom at the moment, which is taking place right across the East Coast mainly and even in WA to a lesser extent, will begin to correct from mid-2016. And that's based on dwelling approvals data and new home sales, et cetera. And what that means is when construction peaks and then starts falling, it means that you need less workers, obviously, and it has an impact on jobs. So as that unwinds, we're likely to also see the housing sector retrenching jobs at the same time as the car industry is retrenching jobs and at the same time as the mining sector is retrenching jobs. So that leaves the question of what's going to fill the void for the economy.
And I'll put that question straight back to you. What is going to fill in the gap for the economy?
Good question. There's always the outside chance that a white knight will come past and save us, but this time I just don't see anything. China's not going to suddenly start building a whole bunch of empty buildings again. So I can't see China drive another commodity uplift. India's not going to suddenly do a China. I honestly can't see anything coming along that'll fill the void left by housing contracting, mining contracting, the manufacturing contracting.
David, you've written very extensively on the iron ore, LNG and coal markets and factors driving those, and how Australia has invested very, very heavily on a particular model of Chinese growth. From there, you've noted that Australia is at great risk if China successfully rebalances its economy away from a model of economic development which requires those Australian inputs. Can you take us through how you're seeing those markets pan out over the next couple of years?
Well, I'm very bearish on all of them. Starting with the big one, which is iron ore, We're at $38 today, roughly. It appears the rebalancing in China's growth that you just described, you know, the shift from construction and manufacturing to services and consumption, is going okay. You know, China's growth is not falling off a cliff in aggregate. However, the old model is unraveling pretty quickly, and that includes the steel sector. And, you know, we now have a situation where housing starts, which constitute 40 to 50% of steel consumption in China, are down about 15% year on year. That's ripping an enormous amount of demand out of steel production in China. And as a result, it looks like we're on the verge of a kind of structural downshift in iron ore demand, not just the progressive falling of demand that we've seen so far, but actually a really big step down. So this is sort of coming, transpiring at the same time that we have Roy Hill coming on stream from Gina. And, you know, there are some other big things happening in iron ore, some that, you know, bought new supply, some that have taken supply out. But in general, supply is still rising. So, you know, the end result is, you know, we could have a surplus in iron ore currently anywhere between 150 and 200 million tonnes. Now, that basically means, you know, the price has to fall low enough to take out at least 100 million tonnes over the next 12 to 18 months.
Well, we have had Sam Walsh this week out cruising the media circuit suggesting that a number of iron ore miners were holding on by their fingertips.
He's exactly right. Well, we pretty much shut down all the two-bit operators that popped up when iron ore was at $190 around the world. What we're left with now is fairly serious players. You know, some are still called juniors, but they've got out. The next block of iron ore miners up to the gallows is the Australian junior sector, which constitutes about 40 million tonnes. That's, you know, Atlas Iron, BC Iron, etc. I expect them all to go bust in the next 12 months and all of that production to come out. I also think that Chinese production of its own iron ore will fall probably another 30 million tonnes, so there's 70 gone. But that still leaves you about half of what you need to lose. So, you know, even if you take that stuff out, I can still see prices continuing to fall next year. And the next cab off the rank, as it were, is Kumba Iron Ore in South Africa and Fortescue Metals here, both of which have break-even costs around $40. So, you know, to upset those two, you have to see the price fall to, you know, well below $40, and probably below $30, because they're not going to close their mines until they've been persuaded that they'll never make money out of them again. And that's down near the cash cost, not the all-in cost. It could be, you know, around anywhere down to sort of $20, $25. So the iron ore outlook's terrible, as it has been for years. And, you know, I would not be surprised to see iron ore deep into the 20s by mid-next year.
That is an ugly prospect for the national economy.
It is, very much so. I mean, that means that no iron ore producer in the world makes money, not even Rio Tinto, the lowest cost producer, which may seem weird, but that's how much of an oversupply there is. And if you look at something like coking coal or nickel, which are also steel inputs, their gluts are much smaller, and yet they're already down to the lowest quartile of producers are the only ones making money. So when you throw the magnitude of glut you've got into iron ore, it's quite possible that everyone just goes under and we have a huge balance sheet accident.
Okay, how's LNG shaping up?
Well, LNG is in the short term, if anything, worse, unbelievably, where Brent oil, which is the benchmark for the LNG contract price, which is what most Australian volumes are sold on, is also free falling, 37 as we speak. It's clearly going to go below its GFC low very soon. And, you know, the glut there is sort of 1 to 2 million barrels a day. And unfortunately, Iran, through a bit of a masterstroke of Obama, is about to re-enter the global oil markets and bring another million barrels in the next 6 months. So that puts the glut back to its highest point that it's been over the last 18 months. And so Brent's going to keep falling. I can see Brent falling deep into the 20s as well, basically rendering the entire Queensland LNG industry insolvent. They won't shut down either, I don't think, but the ramp up in their volumes will be slow and painful, and I suspect all of their supposedly rock solid contracts are going to going to come under immense pressure. So the LNG story is really bad. In the longer term, it's probably better than iron ore, given we may see a rebound in the oil price over time. But
the Russians are preparing for long-term low-cost oil.
Yes. Well, if you look out more than sort of 5 or 10 years, you know, then you're into some serious climate change mitigation impacts onto oil with the rise of, you know, electrified travel. You know, I think the long-term prospects for oil are bad, and the short-term certainly bad, and the medium-term is probably okay. And then coal, well, coal's just buggered, really. Coke and coal is going to follow iron ore down just because it's simpatico in steel. And thermal coal is about to become global public enemy number one. The global coal lobby chief who attended the Paris summit last night declared that all coal miners are now the modern slave traders and will be despised by all and sundry. And I think he's more or less right. You know, it'll take time for, you know, the various movements against coal to coalesce. But, you know, the coal price, the thermal coal price is only going one way as well, even despite India. So the outlook for those three commodities is terrible. And I expect Australia, in terms of trade, to do a full mean reversion as early as the end of next year.
By Jove, that's an ugly prospect.
Leith, for a long time we've been told that as mining tapered off, services would rebound and step into the breach for us. How are we shaping up there?
Look, you know, as the Australian dollar's fallen a bit, we have had a bit of a pickup. Just the usual suspects. Tourism's picked up off a pretty low base. We've had a bit of a rebound in education, but not a whole lot else. And the one thing that's different about this episode of the falling currency is that because of gutted manufacturing, we're not getting the big uplift in manufacturing, which is what you usually get when your economy becomes more competitive from exchange rate devaluation. And unfortunately, because we're allowing the car industry, it's a classic example, because we're allowing that to close down, we're not going to get the uptick in both car exports, but also import competing car sales. And the other interesting thing about the big uplift in services employment, a lot of it's actually been government related. So we're talking about education, healthcare, science. Those have been the big drivers of employment gains really since the GFC. So it does make you wonder how sustainable it is. And
well, as David was noting just a few moments ago, the Reserve Bank governor has been out there highlighting the capital investment free services rebound. So that would have a lot of people questioning the durability of that services performance.
Especially in light of the fact that I've got pretty ginormous housing bubbles in Victoria and New South Wales, which is, you know, creating a big wealth effect, et cetera, and has reduced consumption and debt-based spending and all that sort of thing. With the housing market pretty close to a peak and prices likely to start falling next year and also construction falling, dwelling construction falling, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to say that's going to have a negative wealth effect, which is also going to lead to less services demand.
I'll just touch on something you've referred to there, Leith. Actual house price falls. I was recently at a Christmas drink session with some ABC and Guardian journalists, and it was felt that my view of the economy, which would be broadly akin to yours and or Dave's, was overly gloomy, and that no matter what, it would be unlikely to see house price falls. How do you reply to that sort of suggestion?
Well, you just have to look at the data. I mean, for starters, Australian housing is the most expensive it's ever been. I'm talking, you know, it's led by Melbourne and Sydney, obviously, but most expensive it's ever been against incomes, against GDP, against rents. We've also got the prudential regulator, APRA, and the banks tightening their mortgage lending criteria. And on top of that, we've got the Foreign Investment Review Board, in partnership with the Australian Taxation Office, has just put the clamp on foreign buyers with a brand new supervisory regime and enforcement regime, which is coming on December 1. So there are a lot of factors there which sort of tell you that, you know, it's on borrowed time. It's already looks like it's down in Sydney, where auction clearances have crashed through the floor. We've had quite significant reductions in investor mortgage demand, which has been what's driven price growth in both Sydney and Melbourne. That's just started. So it's sort of hard to believe that prices could stay at the highest they've ever been in the history of Australia indefinitely and just stay in a wonderful plateau as mining investment's falling, as the car industry is closing, as dwelling construction begins to fall from mid next year, which employs a hell of a lot of people as well. And on top of that, as national income growth continues to fall, as commodity prices retrace. So there are a lot of factors there which augur badly for property.
Okay, I'll just touch on something else you've mentioned there. The ATO recently asked for 32 years' worth of data from a range of bodies around Australia That seemed to be covered in the mainstream media as related to illegal foreign investors in Australian real estate, whereas I saw it as going after far, far more, with the rental details and sales and purchase data going back that long, potentially going after lots and lots of undeclared income from mainstream Australian property investor types. Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, I think the whole ATO taking over responsibility for the foreign investment regime was the catalyst for them asking for this information. But I think you're right. They are casting a wider net in that they have also asked for rental data from the tenancy boards in the states, which to me tells you that the ATO is going after property investors, ones who are dodging tax and not disclosing their rental earnings, etc. So
or capital gains.
Or capital gains, that's right. So it does look like they're targeting the whole gamut of property. But I think the foreign investor issue was probably and the fact that the Senate inquiry into foreign investment requires the ATO to set up a national register was the reason why they've asked for it. But while they're at it, they're going to go after domestic investors as well.
You've been listening to part one of the Macro Business 2015 Christmas podcast, a discussion with David Llewellyn-Smith and Leif Van Onselen. Please join us for part two.